Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The men's big dance card, lately full, has dwindled. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest NCAA hoops action. Also, UC Santa Barbara head coach Carlene Mitchell discusses the tall order before her 16th-seeded team as they prepare for number one-ranked Baylor. The Pittsburgh Pirates look to scuttle their long string of losing seasons. And we remember Babe Ruth's 1934 tour of Japan. Also ahead, the weird angles and winter fun of platform tennis.
It's called platform tennis because it's played on a raised platform and there are heaters underneath. Because if it's snowing or if there's ice, you play.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Kyle O'Quinn rules, or at least he did last night when he scored 26 points to lead Norfolk State, a 15 seed in the men's NCAA basketball tournament, past Missouri, a 2 seed. The final score in that one was 86-84. And that wasn't even last night's most astonishing upset. There are lots of reasons why Duke should have beaten Lehigh. Duke didn't have to travel, and Lehigh did. Duke's basketball history includes championships. Lehigh had never previously won a game in the tournament. So, Lehigh, a number 15 seed, 75. Duke, a number 2, 70. St. Patrick's Eve was cruel to Notre Dame. The Irish, a 7 seed, fell to Xavier, a 10 seed, 67-63. Among the other unexpected results was North Carolina State's drubbing of San Diego State, 79-65. The former is an 11 seed, the latter a 6. And just so Buckeye fans wouldn't feel left out, Ohio, a 13 seed, sent home Michigan, a 4 seed. In a few of the games that followed form, Florida State got by St. Bonaventure, but by just 3 points. Georgetown hammered Belmont, 74-59. Florida pasted Virginia, 71-45. North Carolina, a 1 seed, had little trouble with Vermont, a 16 seed. The final in that one was 77-58. In today's games, number 1 seed Kentucky will play Iowa State, and Ohio State, a 2 seed, will attempt to vanquish Gonzaga, a 7 seed this time around. Marquette will face Murray State, and finally, Colorado, an 11 seed, will be trying to channel Norfolk State, Lehigh, et al. When they face Baylor, a 3 seed, tonight. On Thursday, Syracuse defeated UNC Asheville 72-65, prompting Bulldogs head coach Eddie Biedenbaugh to declare, "Syracuse is better than Asheville. Tonight, we were better than Syracuse." Present at that second-round game in Pittsburgh was Syracuse Post-Standard reporter Mike Waters. Mike, the score notwithstanding, was UNC Asheville better than Syracuse on Thursday?
They played better than Syracuse for 38 minutes. And they had to overcome a few calls, but they were right there. They had a chance, but you know they didn't close out the game, and that's part of college basketball. You know, the scoreboard says you got to play for 40, and Syracuse definitely did what they had to do, especially in the last 10 minutes there of the second half, and then the last 2 minutes of the game. You know, making 8 of their last 9 free throws and taking care of the ball and doing what they had to do to avoid history and not become the first 1 seed to lose to a 16 seed in NCAA tournament history.
Syracuse won without center and Big East Defensive Player of the Year Fab Mello. Earlier this week, he was declared ineligible for the tournament. Tell us about the reasons for that.
Well, the university has not publicly stated what the exact reasons were, just saying that he is ineligible. I've been told by a couple of sources that it has to do with academics, but still not exactly sure why. And, of course, you know, the university officials have to cite privacy laws and not going into the students' academic issues. He missed 3 games in the middle of the season back in late January, also due to academics. So I think the 2 suspensions might have something to do with each other, but you know, we're just not absolutely sure right now.
General opinion seems to be that Syracuse is fading and may not go a lot further in this tournament, despite the team's status as a number one seed. Does that seem likely to you?
I don't know that they're fading necessarily, but, you know, obviously they did not play well on Thursday. They're going to miss Fab Mello as they go into the tournament and play bigger teams. You know, UNC Asheville's tallest starter was just 6'5". You know, so Syracuse did not, you know, have to, you know, worry about any big guys in the middle and rebounding issues. But from here on out, they're going to run into bigger, stronger teams, and not having your 7-footer is going to cause problems. And it's just going to take a terrific effort on the part of, you know, some of the other kids who backed up Fab Mello during the regular season and some of the other players on the team, you know, to just increase what they were doing. You know, everyone's got to step up a little because there's not just one guy on the team who can replace Fab Mello in the middle.
Specifically, how does Syracuse stack up against today's third-round opponent, Kansas State?
Kansas State is the exact type of opponent where they're, you know, Syracuse is going to miss Fab Mello the most. Kansas State was the Big 12 Conference's top rebounding team. They get a lot of points off second chance opportunities, so they love to crash the offensive boards. Syracuse has had a lot of problems on their defensive end of the floor in terms of rebounding the basketball all year long, even when they had Fab Mello. So not having him in there could pose a potential problem. Kansas State, they play so hard. They're very physical. They're very aggressive. Syracuse's frontline guys, including the backups to Fab Mello, by Kata, Rakeem Christmas, they're just going to have to match Kansas State's aggressiveness.
Mike, this season has seen serious sexual abuse allegations against former assistant coach Bernie Fine, recent allegations that the basketball program violated the NCAA's policy on recreational drug use, and now the academic issues that have apparently caused the loss of their best player. What's the current mood on campus?
Well, I actually haven't been on campus for so long because I've been on the road following the team from New York City at the Big East Tournament to here in Pittsburgh for the NCAA's year. You know, I know a lot of fans aren't real happy, and they kind of have to muster their support, if you will, for this team. You know, the sexual abuse allegations against the former assistant coach had nothing to do with the players that are on the floor. I think that's what fans are trying to focus on. The drug policy issue, you know, that's something that the school itself reported to the NCAA a year and a half ago, and while the report that came out last week was shocking and troubling, the report had none of the current players involved. Now, for the program in general, I think it's cast a huge shadow over the Syracuse men's basketball program, and one that eventually here, you know, some coaches and administrators are going to have to answer to.
Mike Waters is in Pittsburgh covering the Orange for the Syracuse Post-Standard. Mike, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been a pleasure. You have a good day.
Baylor is the prohibitive favorite in the Women's Division I basketball tournament, which begins today. Will one of the other 63 teams be able to overcome the Bears? The University of California at Santa Barbara gets first crack at them today in Bowling Green, Ohio. Joining me to discuss the Gauchos' chances is head coach Carlene Mitchell. Coach Mitchell, you have been quoted as saying you don't know any three players who can stop Baylor center Brittany Griner. So what do? Cover her with four?
No, I think at the end of the day, you just let her get 50 or 60, and hopefully you can make them make long threes.
Make sure nobody else gets as many as 10.
Exactly, yeah. She might have 60, 75, but if the rest of the team has four, then maybe we have a shot.
I love it. I love your math. Your center, Kirsten Tillman, is about a foot shorter than Griner. I'm wondering if you've been playing old newsreel footage of Bill Russell guarding Wilt Chamberlain for her.
Not yet. I don't want to scare her. So actually, we had one of our men's players who's 7'2" to kind of stand beside her for a reality check.
How'd that work out?
Oh, you know, she has a big heart, so she thinks she's ready for the challenge.
Tell me a little bit about some of the other players on your team that we should watch for today.
You know what? Mel Zornick has done an extremely great job for us in postseason play. She can shoot the three, put it on the floor. So I think she'll be instrumental in, because we're going to have to find a way to score baskets. And we just got to keep the kids free. So she'll probably be one. And then probably the second one will be Nicole Nesbitt. She has the ability to get in the gaps and create for others. So it's going to be extremely important for us to knock down, you know, open jumpers.
You know, there is a tradition for teams that know they're going to the tournament to gather around the television screen during the selection process. I'm wondering what the reaction was when your team found out who they were playing in game one.
There was a few with their hands over their eyes, like, oh, my God, I didn't see this. And then the freshmen who have no clue were jumping up and down all excited. So there was a combination of reactions.
Is it time for a new nickname for your team? I mean, Gaucho just sounds gender-specific to me. Shouldn't it be Gaucha?
You know, I'm not going to get into that one. We'll leave that one up to the people way above my status.
Well, tell me about your short and long-term goals for the team.
I think the short term, I just took the job about, 9 months ago, and my goal was to get them to the NCAA tournament. At the end of the day, there's no better way than to build a foundation of a program by, having your underclassmen experience this, the big dance, and that's ultimately what it's all about. And then year number one, we're there, so I have a feeling that that's expectations from here on out.
Carlene Mitchell is the head coach of the UC Santa Barbara Gauchos. Coach Mitchell, thanks very much for speaking with me, and good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Initially, Peyton Manning, whom the Indianapolis Colts elected not to re-sign on March 7th, announced that he would not work out for whatever teams might be interested in his services. Yesterday, he worked out in North Carolina for Denver Broncos executive John Elway and Broncos coach John Fox, who had flown in for the show. Representatives of the Seattle Seahawks are said to have flown to Denver last weekend to meet with Manning, but apparently they missed connections. I guess the jet sat gleaming on the runway for a while and then flew off, although the Seahawks did connect with Manning a few days later. Manning also worked out for the San Francisco 49ers, who apparently weren't entirely discouraged, since it was reported yesterday that they were still interested, the Tennessee Titans, for whom Manning may also work out, and the Arizona Cardinals also expressed interest. Manning met with representatives of the Cardinals this week for over 6 hours, which is about 2 hours less than he spent with representatives of the Titans, and apparently it wasn't enough. Late yesterday afternoon, the Cardinals were advised that they would be wise to proceed as if they had never heard of Peyton Manning. Has it struck anybody else that by the time the NFL training camps open, Peyton Manning is going to be really tired and perhaps confused? I once heard a story about a high school senior who visited a score of college campuses. Having been accepted by about a dozen of them, she chose one. When her parents drove her to the school in September, she looked around and said, "Hey, this isn't it." Her dad, who had already written the check, said, "Yes, it is," and dropped his daughter off and drove home. I hope that doesn't happen to Peyton Manning. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Guinea pig, 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 guinea pig. I'm told that kangaroos can jump and rabbits do it too. A jumping bean can entertain an easily amused crew. But did you know that guinea pigs are also known to jump? Or one of them, at least I'm told, is certainly no chump when jumping is the thing you wish to see old Truffles do. For Truffles is the champion's name. I promise that it's true. Full 30 centimeters did this Truffles lately leap, and Guinness was on hand with all the records that they keep, and Truffles had them nodding, and they scribbled Truffles' name in that great book that chronicles the goofy search for fame. I'm told the record-setting jump occurred somewhere in Fife. To Scotland's Truffles, we all wish a long and leaping life. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Babe Ruth, ambassador to Japan. But first, September 14th, 2011 was the day the woeful Pittsburgh Pirates clinched a 19th straight losing season. a record in American pro sports. Only a Game's Ron Schachter recently visited the Pirates' spring training home in Bradenton, Florida, where players, coaches, and fans are wondering if the hapless Bucks can avoid extending their own record for futility.
The Pirates are no strangers to baseball success. From their first World Series championship back in 1909, the heyday of Pirates immortal Honus Wagner, to their last title in 1979, when future Hall of Famer Willie Stargell led the team to the tune of a popular song that became their mantra.
We are family. Get up, everybody, and sing.
80-year-old former Pirates manager Bill Verdon still coaches the outfielders during spring training. As a Pirates player, he was on the way to the on-deck circle when teammate Bill Mazeroski stunned the New York Yankees with his famous walk-off home run to clinch the 1960 World Series. The Pirates' more recent losing ways, including last year's 70-92 record, are harder for Verdon to swallow.
Well, that's no fun. You know, it's tough to live with, but it's part of the game, and you got to go from... When you have a bad year, you got to build on it and go from there, and that's what we hope to be doing now.
What happens when you have 19 bad years?
We're not planning on that. We hope we don't have 20. We're planning on having a winning year this year.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to historic McKechnie Field, home of your 2012 Pittsburgh Pirates.
Long-suffering Pirates fans, meanwhile, have grown hoarse from the rallying call, "Wait till next year." Does 26-year-old Mike Schaefer even remember when a young Barry Bonds led Pittsburgh to the postseason in the early 1990s?
Vaguely, I was seven. Yeah, I remember Vance Leck and Bonds being here, yeah, Ebony and all those guys.
Schaefer offers a succinct explanation of why the Pirates haven't been winners since then.
A lot of bad decisions, a lot of bad luck.
Retired school superintendent Tony Krakowski adds that it's been hard to stay hopeful.
Every spring brings, eternal optimism, but it gets tougher and tougher each year.
Along with their 19-season losing streak, the Pirates have earned the reputation as baseball's most notorious tightwads. Their 2011 payroll, at $45 million, was the National League's cheapest, despite the fact that the Pirates enjoy steady revenue from their showpiece stadium, PNC Park, and tens of millions of dollars more from Major League Baseball's revenue-sharing program and national television contract. Krukowski thinks the Pirates could do business differently.
I think most people feel that we could field a better team than what we've been fielding if ownership was willing to pay a little bit more for some free agents, that type of thing. I mean, they're doing a good job of developing young players, and they're doing a good job in the draft, but we never go after the top names in the free agency.
And in recent years, Pittsburgh routinely traded their best players, including star hitters Freddie Sanchez, Jason Bay, and Nate McLouth, rather than pay their escalating salaries.
Batting fifth, the third baseman number 24, Pedro Alvarez.
But there are signs of a Pirates revival, thanks to a bevy of young hitters, a steady staff of starters, and a plethora of top draft picks in the minor leagues. Last year, the Pirates played winning baseball for the first 4 months of the season. They even jockeyed for first place in the NL Central Division before sinking after the All-Star break, when several starting pitchers got injured. Along the way, notes Pirates TV analyst Kent DeCulvey, the Pirates brought fans back to PNC Park.
If this team can consistently get, better and be in a position where you could, at least be in a position where you can compete for something, they will show up in droves. I can't remember how many sellouts we had in the first 4 months when we were playing so well last year, and that just hadn't happened in the past because all those people that were waiting finally had what they wanted. They had something to get excited about, and they did all show up.
Last season's first-half success left a lasting impression on All-Star outfielder Andrew McCutchen, who led the team with 23 home runs and 89 RBIs.
Everything worked from the beginning to the end, from offense to defense. We all had it clicking for us. Even if the offense wasn't as well, the pitching would step up. They would pitch well and take care of it for us. But we had each other's back. Just got to continue just to keep doing that, and we'll have a good season.
Earlier this month, the Pirates showed they had McCutchen's back, signing him to a 6-year, $51.5 million contract extension. Last summer, they also extended the contract of fellow outfielder and rising star Jose Tabata. Even the once-traded Nate McLouth is back from his three-season exile in Atlanta.
It was exciting to watch from the outside, watching them play so well through the first 4 months of the season. And I know that we've got an even better team this year. And the motto around here has been to finish. And we can do that, we'll be fine.
Pittsburgh opens the regular season at home on April 5th against the Philadelphia Phillies. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
Thank you! Thank you, baby! Let's get
Bell's bell at you here.
Yeah!
Reserve 7, Row 10. You've got coupons coming to Bell's Department Store. Reserve 7 and Row 10.
In 1934, after several seasons of saying he wouldn't go, Babe Ruth traveled to Japan. He was accompanied by lots of other major league ballplayers and by Connie Mack, who managed the Philadelphia Athletics for 50 years. Ruth, with his home runs, was the star of the traveling show, but when Robert Fitz began researching the trip, he found lots of other reasons to write about it. That's why his book, Banzai Babe Ruth, is subtitled Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination during the 1934 Tour of Japan. The author joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Robert Fitz, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
There was a general sense among the U.S. ball players, and it was a sense shared by the U.S. ambassador to Japan, that the trip would have a beneficial effect on relations between the U.S. and Japan. What was the state of that relationship in 1934?
The United States and Japan were on the road to war, even in the early 30s. Both were rivals in the Pacific, both wanted to have the strongest navies in the Pacific, and both were rivals in China. Both wanted to control the trade in the country. So Japan was expanding, as was the United States around the Pacific Rim, and they were in a collision course.
Major League Baseball players had toured Japan before 1934, but they'd never had Babe Ruth along for the ride. How did his presence affect the adventure?
Babe Ruth, of course, is the god of baseball, and he was no less the god in Japan. Everybody knew who he was. You didn't have to be a baseball fan to know who Babe Ruth was. So he was the entire focus of the tour. I mean, it's true, the team had Lou Gehrig, the team had Jimmy Fox, Connie Mack, and these players were well known in Japan, but it was really all about Babe Ruth.
Well, before the players reached Japan, the shenanigans began, or at least they may have. Tell us the story of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig's wife, Eleanor, a mountain of caviar, and an ocean of champagne.
Well, as everybody probably knows, Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth had a falling out. There were many stories about why this occurred, as the most popular story was that Lou Gehrig's mother made certain comments about why Babe Ruth's natural daughter was always poorly dressed when his stepdaughter was well-dressed. But there's another rumor going around, and the rumor was that on the way over, Babe Ruth and Eleanor Gehrig may have had a quick affair. And the evidence, it was a rumor. I had never seen it in print before, but in Eleanor Gehrig's autobiography, she tells this story about how she went down with Claire Ruth, Babe's wife, to apologize for the falling out with the family. And Eleanor does talk a little bit about this misunderstanding over how the Ruth daughters were dressed. Mm-hmm. And then she says the Babe was in his suite surrounded by a mound of caviar and drinking champagne. Eleanor Gehrig, you have to remember, grew up in affluence. She was used to being surrounded by the finer things in life, but her family lost most of their money in the Depression. And then she married a ball player at a time where ball players didn't make as much money as they do today. So she supposedly couldn't resist the caviar and the champagne and sat down with the Babe and spent 2 hours in there. Well, Gehrig was upstairs on the top of the ship looking for her, and he was frantic. He's like, where could his new bride, they're on their honeymoon, have gone? And he actually organized a search party, and they searched the ship from top to bottom, and he concluded she fell overboard. So he wanted the ship to circle around and start looking for her in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, when all of a sudden she shows up. Apparently she must have been kind of tipsy as well. And Lou Gehrig just went ice cold, apparently. He just glared at her and walked away and didn't speak to her for several days. Lou, I guess, feared the worst.
Once the actual baseball games were underway, it became apparent that the Japanese teams were incapable of providing much in the way of competition. The major leaguers went undefeated. Did that matter?
Not so much. The Japanese players and the American players knew that the Americans were there to teach the finer points of the game and to provide excitement for the fans because the Japanese were about to start their professional league. They needed the fans to get ready to embrace professional baseball. There was even a sense that professionalism sullied the sport and that the true sport needed to remain amateur. So by watching Gehrig and Ruth and Fox, the idea was to show how well they can conduct themselves, and therefore Japan could also embrace professional baseball. Prior to going over there, the Commissioner of Baseball, Judge Landis, sent an open letter to the team emphasizing that they were ambassadors for the United States and ambassadors for Major League Baseball, and that unlike previous tours, the players were supposed to behave themselves, and they would take it very seriously if they misbehave. By all accounts, they did behave themselves.
Except for on the trip over.
Perhaps. But they weren't in Japan at that point, so it was all right.
Was there any evidence that the 1934 trip did improve relations between the two countries?
They certainly did temporarily. If you go back and look at the newspapers from 1934, almost every story about Japan in the American press is negative. The Japanese army had invaded Manchuria in 1931. They're in the process of leaving the League of Nations. All the press was negative to Japan. But for 1 month, the month of November 1934, just about every story was positive. They talked about how wonderful the Japanese fans were, how they embraced baseball. And there was a real naive feeling back then that if a country could embrace baseball, they could embrace democracy as well. They believed baseball taught fair play. And thus, if you could play fairly on the diamond, you can learn to play fairly in the international sphere as well.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, Babe Ruth took it personally. Describe his reaction to the news.
Well, first, you have to understand that Babe Ruth loved the press and he believed the press. So when the reporters were writing in December of 1934 that Babe Ruth had forestalled any possible conflict between the United States and Japan because of baseball, he really took it to heart. And he felt very close to the Japanese people. He loved this trip to Japan. So apparently he started running around his apartment on Riverside Drive in Manhattan, grabbing up Japanese souvenirs who his wife Claire had decorated the living room with, pulled open the window, and tossed them out of his apartment onto Riverside Drive below, shattering vases, dolls. And Claire's running around in front of him, you know, looking to see where he's going to look next. And his eyes go to the mantelpiece. So she runs to the mantelpiece and grabs all she can before he runs over and grabs what's left and tosses it. And luckily, Claire was a very intelligent woman. She grabbed all the good stuff. But a lot of the tchotchkes, you know, that were decorating this apartment were completely destroyed and left on the street.
Is there any record of whether Babe Ruth ever moved beyond the sense of personal betrayal he felt on December 7th, 1941?
There's not a strong record of that. He remained very popular in Japan after the war. It's very usual to see magazine covers with Babe Ruth on the covers in 48 and around his death. And after he died, the Japanese participated in Babe Ruth Day, which was a American Major League Baseball, let's call it a holiday, to honor Ruth. So although I don't have any statements from Ruth saying anything like, I forgive the Japanese, or it's time to come together, or anything like that, the Japanese once again embraced him after World War II.
Various sources, including the Sporting News, concluded shortly after Pearl Harbor that, quote, the Japanese did not even deserve to play baseball. What was their reasoning there exactly?
That's correct. That goes back to what I mentioned earlier. There was this belief within baseball circles that baseball had almost supernatural powers, that by playing baseball you learn fair play, you can learn democracy. It was a gift. It was the American national game, and there was something special about it. So the idea that Japan could do something underhanded like Pearl Harbor was against the fair play on the baseball diamond. So that's where they're coming from.
No, it seems extraordinary to me that very shortly after the end of the Second World War, U.S. ballplayers were once again touring Japan. Tell us a little about how that happened and what it accomplished.
Very few non-baseball fanatics know of a fellow named Lefty O'Doul. He was a several-time batting champ in the late 1920s, 1930s, and he helped organize the 1934 tour. He was the major league player who worked with the Yomiuri newspaper from Tokyo to help bring the players over there. During the 31 and 34 tour, O'Doul formed a friendship with a Japanese man named Satoru Suzuki. As soon as the war was over, 1946, O'Doul bought a ticket to Japan with his own money and went straight over to Tokyo to look for his old friends. And then he sat down with Suzuki and said, "How can we bring baseball back as soon as possible?" Their belief was that Japan needed baseball to help build morale, and on top of that, it could help mend ties between the two countries. Luckily enough, MacArthur was also a baseball fan, and O'Doul brought over the San Francisco Seals. He was at that point manager, 1949, the San Francisco Seals, and it was another great success. Hundreds of thousands of people came out to watch the Seals and to cheer them. A number of sources, not just baseball writers, but even newspaper writers, said this tour of the Seals perhaps did more to heal a lot of the wounds of the war than any other single action.
Robert Fitz is the author of Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination During the 1934 Tour of Japan. The book is published by the University of Nebraska Press, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Robert, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Great. Thanks very much.
Uncle Sam, when you play ball, the rules must all be fair. Your name is in our golden frame for playing on the square. Uncle Sam, we've made a vow since that Pearl Harbor raid. And now it's up to you to show them how the game is played. You're gonna win that ball game, Uncle Sam. So pitch that cannonball the way you can. You were slow beginning, but just wait till that ninth inning. You can finish.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
There are lots of ways to fill out the brackets in the NCAA basketball tournaments. You can avoid coaches who've cheated. You can base your choices on uniform colors. Some folks even try to figure out which teams will win. And now you can base your choices on the popularity of the names of mascots as reflected in the names of pets across the land. A provider of pet insurance this week revealed that in the company database there are 1,311 pets named Duke and 1,282 named Bear. The company's contention is that this augurs well for Duke, obviously, and Baylor, whose mascot is a bear. There are also 10 pets named Kansas, which seems unlikely, and 180 named Murray, most of whom must be greyhounds or cheetahs, since Murray State's nickname is the Racers. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, tennis outside in the winter in a steel cage. But first, from Tucson, Charlie Pierce joins me for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Anything in a steel cage is fine by me.
You're on the record now, and we'll move right along. Let's start by talking about NFL free agent signings by those not named Manning, Peyton. Those not familiar with a defensive end named Mario Williams will soon become so. He just signed with the Bills for 6 years and up to $100 million. Some say he'll be a game changer for Buffalo. What do you think?
He's one of the best there is, and he will be a game changer for Buffalo. And Tom Brady just got a nervous twitch and doesn't know why.
Calvin Johnson, a.k.a. Megatron, which is pretty scary, inked a mega deal on Wednesday. The All-Pro wide receiver's 8-year deal with Detroit is worth $132 million, 60 of those million guaranteed. That's the biggest contract in NFL history. Is he worth it?
Well, there are scouts who will tell you that no wide receiver is worth it, but he's become a signature player in Detroit. So I guess, you know, if you get a Megatron, it's cheap at any price.
This was also the week of personnel moves in the NBA. As that league's trade deadline passed on Thursday, the Portland Trailblazers cut 24 going on 84-year-old Greg Oden. They fired their coach, Nate McMillan, and in two separate transactions traded Marcus Camby and Gerald Wallace for Hasheem Thabeet, Johnny Flynn, Mehmet Okur, and Sean Williams. Will fans at tomorrow's home game against Golden State recognize anybody in their team's uniforms?
Well, if you're going to bring in a new coach, you might as well bring in a new team as well. They always say a new coach spends 3 days learning everybody's name. Well, you might as well have all the players learn the coach's name, too.
The Lakers shook up their roster as well. They sent veteran point guard Derek Fisher to Houston and acquired Ramon Sessions from Cleveland, among other moves. Do you think they were motivated by the other L.A. team clipping at their heels?
Oh, very nice. Derek Fisher leaving the Lakers is more of an event than it would appear. He's been, you know, a good piece of the soul of that team during its recent successful run.
Carmelo Anthony wants to remain where he is in New York with the Knicks. Do you think that decision has anything to do with the resignation this week of the head coach, Mike D'Antoni, there?
Well, the Knicks are a little stuck. They tore the entire team apart to trade for him when he was in Denver. So I think they're a little bit stuck with him right now. But I think that all things being equal, they would have gotten rid of him with D'Antoni.
The UConn Huskies were knocked out of the big dance during Thursday's first round. It's the first time since 1996 that a defending champion has gone out that early, but given that the Huskies were a 9 seed facing an 8 seed in Iowa State, was it really, as some say, I'm quoting now, the end of an era?
No, I don't know that it's the end of an era. Jim Calhoun is 70 years old. He's got to be thinking about retirement at that point. His health hasn't been the best. He's accomplished everything he could possibly accomplish at Connecticut. Why he didn't retire after last year's NCAA championship, I don't know.
The president of the United States has picked North Carolina to win the men's NCAA tournament and Baylor to take the top honors on the women's side. I guess he's probably pretty much guaranteed to get at least one of those, right? Don't you think?
Well, I was going to say he's way out on a limb on that women's pick. Nobody's beaten Baylor this year. I think he's in trouble with North Carolina, though. They are a very good team that does not always play that way.
Well, I have to follow up and ask you who wins then.
I believe if I look back at, and I don't have my brackets with me, believe it or not, I do not carry them everywhere I go in March. Kentucky's the best team in the country. Kentucky's going to win the national championship.
Andy Pettitte is a Yankee again. The left-handed pitcher turns 40 in June. He retired last February to spend more time with his family, and I guess his wife must have said, go get a job.
Yeah, to heck with them. I'm going back with the Yankees, says Andy. I forgot how boring these people are. No, I mean, you know, the Yankees are bolstering what is already a pretty formidable rotation. And if Pettitte's in shape, he can help.
Yeah, it's safe to say they gave him a minor league contract, so Sure. Who knows if this actually ends up with him on the roster. The Iditarod has a new youngest champion, Charlie. 25-year-old Dallas Seavey arrived in Nome Tuesday in 9 days, 4 hours, 29 minutes, and 26 seconds. He beat out his father, a former Iditarod champion, and his grandfather, who was also in the race. The kid's been training since he was 5. What took him so long?
I have no idea, but I got to admire Gramps for still hanging in there. And I think outside of the Iditarod, I think cricket is the only thing that measures its sport in days.
Charlie, we don't talk about television shows much, but I have been enjoying the series titled Luck on HBO. It's filmed at Santa Anita, the racetrack in California, but there will apparently be no second season. If more people had been watching, would that show have gone on despite the death of three horses?
I think it might have, but I think the death of three horses was a real show killer, if you know what I mean. They certainly pumped enough money into it. They had an A-plus list cast. This is the reality of racing. Horses die. And, you know, if you're gonna take heed about horses dying, you can't do a realistic film about a racetrack.
And finally, Charlie, everybody knows that the NCAA basketball tournaments inspire millions of fans across the nation, including the aforementioned president of the United States, to catch bracket fever. So how come Max Cole of Omaha, Nebraska, got in trouble for his endeavors along that line?
Because Max is still in elementary school where they frown on gambling, apparently, in Omaha.
He set up a pool, and he said to his classmates, hey, everybody chip in $5. We're going to do this thing.
$5. Remember, I was in elementary school. $5 was all the money in the world. I predict great things for Max, by the way. Perhaps even a job on ESPN by the time he's 13.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. And, of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Clear the decks, clear the tracks. We got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow.
Baby, everything's coming out rosy.
Those are penguins, and they sound angry, and that's because in my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, Charlie referred to penguins, quote, walking across the Arctic. He's done this before, but this time it irked not only the penguins, but listener Dave Pearson, who emailed to point out that penguins live in the Antarctic, as well as in South Africa and Chile. Eric Roskus, who hears the show on WYPR in Baltimore, was similarly moved to email. I love Charlie Pierce, he wrote, but you might remind him that aside from Pittsburgh, penguins live in the zoo and in the Antarctic. We mentioned last week that Greg Williams, the former defensive coordinator for the New Orleans Saints, had acknowledged that he oversaw a system established to pay bounties to players who knocked members of the opposition out of the game. In a commentary this week, carried by various NPR stations, I revisited that topic to the dismay of Joe Schott, a Saints fan, who left a very long message on our Facebook page. Mr. Schott opines that the Saints were by no means the dirtiest team in the league and regards what he calls the vagueness of statements by Greg Williams and others associated with the Saints as evidence that the entire issue has been blown out of proportion, probably at the instigation of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. I invite you to partake of that commentary by visiting us on Facebook at Only a Game Radio. In another comment on the subject of bounty hunting among the Saints, David Greenberg of Annapolis, Maryland and Delray Beach, Florida, emailed as follows, "Bounties have been and always will be. Watch Slapshot. In the movie, the Paul Newman character announces a bounty on Ogie Oglethorpe." Mr. Greenberg apparently makes no distinction between art, however brilliant, and life. In a commentary during the show last week, I celebrated Leo Messi's performance for FC Barcelona in the Champions League game, during which Messi scored 5 times. "Thanks for the well-deserved shout-out," wrote Martin Friedrichs, who hears the show via the podcast, "but the team Barcelona was playing is Bayer Leverkusen. Bayern is the team from Munich." Distinctions like that give me a headache. And finally, Greg Anderson of Storrs, Connecticut, home of the UConn Huskies, emailed as follows, "We listen every week. Yours is the best, most balanced sports show, and you often feature women's sports. I am thus always surprised when you say NCAA basketball and then only discuss the men's game. Maybe you could at least add the gender adjective and make it clear you're talking about the men's side of the sport." Fair enough. The UConn men lost Thursday night and went home to Storrs. The UConn women face Prairie Valley A&M today. Man or woman, boy or girl, you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. You can register your opinions at onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. This weekend on Long Island, New York, more than 400 men and women are playing in the American Platform Tennis Association's National Championships. Platform tennis features intense competition in a small area surrounded by chicken wire. You might call it the tennis version of a steel cage match if the players weren't so darn friendly. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
So imagine a tennis court, but it's only 20 feet wide by 40 feet long. Has a net in the middle. It looks just like a tennis court. Service boxes, alleys. But outside of the court, right next to the court, is chicken wire, tight wire that surrounds the court, called a cage.
That's Tim McAvoy. He's the president of the American Platform Tennis Association. Those chicken wire cages extend 12 feet in the air and give the game of platform tennis a sound all its own. McAvoy lives in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and has been playing platform tennis for nearly 30 years.
You play the sport the same as tennis. You have to hit it over the net. It has to land in the court. But if you hit it hard enough, it goes over the net, lands in the court, it hits the wires, and you can play it off the wires before it bounces a second time on your side. So that's what takes away just the raw, brute power and makes it much more of a kind of a chess match.
On this late February Saturday, Center Court Athletic Club in Chatham, New Jersey, is one of 5 area clubs hosting championships for men and women in age groups ranging from over 40 to over 65. The skies are clear, but the wind is whipping through the courts, and it's chilly. APTA Executive Director Ann Sheedy says two men in Scarsdale, New York, invented the sport in the 1920s.
They were tennis players, and they wanted to get out of the house in the winter, and so they created a wooden platform. And they got tired of chasing the ball in the snow, so that's how they came up with the idea of putting the screens around the court. One time, somebody played the ball off the screen, and they thought that was a great addition to the sport.
McAvoy says since those days, court construction has evolved.
There are heaters underneath, because if it's snowing or if there's ice, you play. The heaters melt the snow or the ice, and the surface of the court, the aluminum surface, has rough grit on it, almost like sand that's been painted into it, so the balls don't skid when it's wet.
The balls are neon green, like a regular tennis ball, but have a solid foam rubber core. The rackets look like oversized ping pong paddles with holes drilled through them. And a quick point of clarification, many platform tennis players call their game paddle tennis. However, there is a separate racket sport officially known as paddle tennis, but that's a story for another edition of Only a Game. John Milbank is a tennis pro at a country club in Morristown, New Jersey. He first heard about platform while working at another local club.
For 6 years, I refused to even go up and look at it. It looks so silly.
But 20 years ago, Milbank gave it a shot and got hooked. Platform is a doubles game, and Milbank and his partner, Mike Atkinson, would eventually win last month's men's 45 and older title. Milbank says it's a humbling sport for regular tennis players who are used to admiring their own aces and winners.
The points are so long, and you know, if you're kind of stuck on yourself, you know, it's easy to kind of get frustrated when guys are getting balls back. You might be dominating the point and lose it anyway. And it might be a super long point, but the teams that hustle and have a will, rather than, you know, all caught up in their own skill, they tend to play better.
I got it. You're there, it's good.
At the Short Hills Club in Short Hills, New Jersey, matches in the women's 40-plus tournament are underway. The wind gusts are still strong. Clouds roll in, and some snow squalls provide a glimpse of the kind of conditions players see during most winters. Platform players call their opponents' shots in or out. Line judges are only used at championship finals. Wilmington, Delaware resident Cindy Prendergast has won multiple women's and mixed national championships. She says sportsmanship is part of the culture.
Some of the worst-behaved tennis players actually end up being nice on the paddle court, and it's still competitive, but there's something about our group that just won't allow that kind of bad behavior. So we all just really try hard and we compete hard, but at the end of the day, we have a beer with each other and get ready for the next tournament.
Platform's traditional hub is in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. But the APTA reports that Chicago has the fastest-growing U.S. platform community. There's also been some growth in Atlanta and parts of Florida and Arizona. Platform hit its peak in the 1970s when there were sponsors and cash prizes for major tournaments. A court with a heater can cost as much as $70,000, one reason it's primarily a country club sport. Today, only a handful of spectators have turned out, but the sport has fans in the world of elite tennis. Todd Martin was a panelist at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston earlier this month. Martin was once ranked fourth in the world, played on the 1995 U.S. Davis Cup Championship team, and reached the finals in the Australian and U.S. Opens.
I grew up in the Midwest in very cold climates. So my dad and I used to, you know, when it was cold out and when it was snowing, we'd go down to the platform tennis court and play that. And it was a lot of fun for me because I got to play with adults and play doubles.
Martin says after a long time away from platform, he picked up a racket again a few years ago.
The game is really very interesting, and you got to be careful about how hard you hit the ball. And it's dangerous because you're playing with a heavy ball, and you know, oftentimes the best solution is to try to hit the guy on the other side of the court. But it's a game that I know lots of the guys that I played junior tennis with play awfully well now.
During a break in the action at Short Hills Club, former APTA president Mark Fischel summed up the allure of a small outdoor tennis court inside a chicken wire fence.
Most winters, unlike this one, it'll be 10 degrees out, the wind will be howling, there'll be weather warnings, stay inside, bundle up. If you go out for short periods, and I'll be going out to play, and we'll play an hour and a half, 2 hours, we'll have a beer afterwards, and I'll drive home and I'll have icicles on the tip of my hair. But I just spent 2 hours with my buddies outside, got some great exercise, and had a blast. How could you not be addicted?
The American Platform Tennis Association's national championships continue today in New York, with the men's and women's finals scheduled for tomorrow. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Doug's platform tennis photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from British Prime Minister David Cameron, who expresses appreciation for Barack Obama's recent assistance.
He's giving me some tips. He's going to help me fill out my bracket.
And he's going to teach me cricket.
You know, filling out a bracket takes minutes. For me, seconds. But learning cricket, that can take centuries. Get it? Centuries? That's a little cricket pun. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.